Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Glasgow School of Social Work seminar series. This talk was recorded on the 22nd of March 2011. Fergus McNeill, Glasgow School of Social Work, Inspiring Dissidents, Arts Projects in Scottish Prisons.
I'm going to talk about Inspiring Dissidents today, which is based on an evaluation report looking at a recent initiative in Scottish prisons. I'm going to get into it very quickly. I'm going to give you a little video clip which explains the very basics about what the project that we evaluated was about. It's part of a much longer film which you can access online. So I think I'll just start with the clip and then take it from there.
Inspiring Change was a coordinated programme.
Okay, that's just enough to give you a flavour and spares me the job of having to describe everything that happened. So hopefully... This is currently the draft of the final report, the evaluation report, and this is the multidisciplinary team that was referred to in the film. So there are colleagues here who are in the field of music, modern languages, criminology, social work and education, adult education, all represented in an evaluation team. The project had several aims and objectives, but I want to focus attention in this presentation on just a couple of these. So one of the aims, the third aim here, is to demonstrate the potential of the arts to support the process of rehabilitation. Obviously that's the bit of this that I was most interested in and had most to say about. Amongst the objectives then, to evaluate the impact of engagement in these programmes on offenders' attitudes and behaviours, as well as on their ability to learn, and to positively link prisoners with their families and communities through art. So those are the two specific objectives that I'm going to dwell on and focus on in the evaluation. It's a lengthy report, as you might imagine, with so many contributors and so many issues to try to address. So this is just a snippet, if you like, an extract that deals specifically with the issues around dissidence from crime. This is the range of projects. You've heard them explained briefly on the film, so I'll skip past this slide and then just talk a little bit briefly about what the evaluation involved. This was a ridiculously cheap evaluation given the amount of research effort that went into it. I won't tell you what it cost. I'd be embarrassed to tell you how cheaply we sold ourselves on this one. But we did an awful lot of empirical work. I have to say I didn't do it. There was a particular field worker involved, Kirsten Anderson, who did the vast majority of the data collection. But the staff of the prisons, of the learning centres, the arts practitioners themselves all made very significant contributions in terms of generating the data that we looked at. But the full range is represented on this slide, but the two bits that I'm really focusing on in the data that I'll show you later are prisoner data itself, the feedback from the men who were involved in focus groups at two stages in their involvement with the different arts projects. At one stage, roughly about a week into the process, so that they knew what they had got into, but it hadn't probably had its impact by that point. And then again towards the end or at the completion of each of the projects. So that's what I'm going to draw from here. The literature review that we did for the final evaluation report is itself quite an extensive and I think quite a useful document, but I'm just going to give you highlights here. First of all, drawn from arts research itself and then drawn from research linking arts and literacy in prisons. And then I'll get on to dissidence in a moment, which is more my field. So, summarising rather brutally, the key claims of recent research on the arts in prison: it can develop better relationships between offenders, prison staff and families. It can improve self-esteem and self-confidence. It can develop communication and social skills, and it can enable people to work as part of a group. That's a summary of a developing body of evaluation evidence about arts interventions of the sort described here. Just one caveat: this isn't art therapy. It's not the use of art in deliberately planned therapeutic processes. It's simply arts intervention, so the opportunity to participate in an arts project of one sort or another, which may or may not have therapeutic outcomes and may or may not be experienced as a therapeutic process, but it's not designed to be therapeutic. It's simply focused on the process of producing the artwork itself and then going through to performance or exhibition or whatever suits the given art form. But in spite of the fact that arts interventions kind of don't really need an additional justification beyond the basic goodness of being involved in art, the opportunity for self-expression, the fact that arts contributes to our quality of life in general, and that should be as true for prisoners as it is for everybody else. Nonetheless, this body of evidence begins to point to the fact that there are instrumental benefits that come from participation in arts projects. And on literacy, the evidence is summarised here. So arts interventions help to engage and change negative attitudes to education. And that's very typical, of course, of prisoners, that they have very negative attitudes towards formal education, usually based on very negative previous experiences. It provides contextualised activities that are interesting and fun, in which literacy skills are used and developed in ways that are very different from classroom teaching that they might have experienced at school. So it gets them interested, it gets them active, it gets them learning without making learning the explicit focus. It builds or extends the knowledge and skills that offenders or prisoners possess, and helps them to make progress with the development of those skills. It provides a range of activities that help people work on their strengths, but also in collaboration with peers. There's a lot of evidence about team working that's involved in the creative process. And obviously that can vary to some extent depending on the art form or the medium. If you're doing self-portrait and you're doing it in your cell by yourself, that might seem like a very solitary experience, but in the projects that did involve portraiture in shots, for example, in spite of the fact that the artist's engagement with the canvas is a very individual thing, they were in one room working on these portraits together. They were talking collectively as a group about their experience of developing the skills and doing the portraiture. So there was a collective element even in the more apparently isolated or individualised art forms. Certainly with drama, participation as a team in the development of a theatrical production or a musical performance, the teamwork elements are much more obvious. Lastly, on this slide, the participation in arts projects can increase confidence and self-esteem by increasing skills and encouraging social interaction through this working together on absorbing projects. So it's not quite accidental learning. People who run these projects intend this learning and this development to take place. But nonetheless, because it's organised around activities that are experienced as being interesting, fun, engaging in various ways, it reaches, if you like, an audience which is a hard-to-reach audience for traditional education. And then if we begin to try to link this to some of the evidence about desistance from crime, about how and why people stop offending, well, the first thing to say is that prisons in and of themselves are exceptionally poor contexts for efforts to desist from crime. The three major strands in desistance theory relate to age and maturation, developing maturity and responsibility, to developing positive social bonds, ties. Sometimes the literature refers to these as stakes and conformity, a reason to go straight, which might relate to relationships or employment or other kinds of activity. And then the third strand is identity theory based or linked to narrative shifts in the way that individuals construct their sense of self. Now, if you put somebody in a prison, the nature of imprisonment, the total institution, the control of the daily routine, being subject to a regime that makes decisions for you on an hour-by-hour, almost minute-by-minute basis, means that it's not a natural context for becoming more mature or more responsible. It can't really deliver the opportunities that that secure or support maturation. Prison is de facto the disruption of positive social ties. You're severed from positive social ties that exist in the community, and you're forced into close association with other people who share the criminal identity and the prisoner label. So it's not the good place for developing positive social ties, and it is a good place for cementing negative identities. If you want to use the old sociological term, deviant identities. There's no better place than a prison to cement those negative identities. Now, I'm not saying that prisons can't do good work and that prison regimes can't be better or worse in relation to these dynamics, but prison as an institution is not the most promising when we think about desistance from crime. But arts projects, perhaps, even from the very brief review of the literature that I've just taken you through, might offset some of that by helping offenders to engage in their own learning and in development processes by helping them to recognise and develop existing strengths and the positive potential that exists within them, by building their self-esteem or self-confidence, by using and encouraging peer support and team or group work, by enabling them to think differently about themselves, their families, their relationships with peers, their relationships to the prison regime and the prison experience, and by helping them to imagine different possible futures, different social networks, different identities, different lifestyles that are opened up or can be opened up by participation in arts. And to give you a famous Scottish example or two, think about Jimmy Boyle in the special unit, or think about Hugh Collins in the special unit, two men whose process of personal transformation and change was linked to discovery of their potential as artists in that context. But, the big caveat, desistance is a complex process, and it would be naive in the extreme to expect a short period of participation in an arts project to address all of the difficulties and all of the obstacles that face a person engaged in that complex and difficult process. So to give you a bit more background on that complexity, I've kind of explained the three major theoretical strands that are around in desistance theory. This diagram just tries to link the three together. Most desistance scholars now say that desistance rests not in becoming older and more mature alone, nor in social bonds alone, nor in identity construction alone, but rather in the interactions between all three things. So we have interactionist accounts of desistance that stress the relationships between developing maturity, generative activities, the potential to work or to engage in family life, the process through life transitions that create different opportunities to forge positive social ties and social bonds, and the way in which those processes of transition are underwritten or undermined by narrative shifts in identity construction. Now, I'm not going to give you a big lecture on desistance theory. There isn't time on this occasion to do that. But this begins to give you the kind of gist of the complexity of the process. And this slide just sums up five or six key lessons from desistance research. And again, I'm painting necessarily with a very, very broad brush. These processes are complex. They are not events. It's very rare for there to be a light bulb moment when somebody instantly, simply, by force of will, commits to desistance and then succeeds in the project without lapse or relapse. More likely, the experience is characterised by ambivalence and vacillation. So ambivalence means pointing in different directions, sometimes pointing straight towards the destination, if you like, of integration and inclusion and leaving crime behind, sometimes pointing back towards the illicit networks and their opportunities and their temptations and so on. And some days, as with any behaviour change process, as I'm sure you can relate to, when any of us are trying to change our behaviour, some days we're highly motivated and enthusiastic about the change that we're embarked upon. To give you a bit of self-disclosure, some days I wake up thrilled at the prospect of going on my run, building my fitness, getting ready for the next event or race. And some days I wake up and all I want is a long lie, a cup of coffee, two croissants with butter and jam, and you can forget the run. So it's characteristic of human change processes that we experience ambivalence and vacillation. We're not always straightforward in our trajectory towards achieving these changes. The processes also involve rebiography. I've talked about narrative or identity change. It's not that clear yet from the research to what extent the identity change in desistance happens as desistance happens, or whether it's a kind of post hoc, after the event, rationalisation of what's happened. We don't know the answer to that for sure yet, but certainly shifting identities, particularly, especially for those who have well-established criminalised identities, that's an important part of the process. So this is much bigger than learning a new set of skills, whether cognitive or problem-solving or any other skills that traditional programmes seek to target. Those are important, but they're not sufficient. Desistance can be prompted by life events, but it depends on the meaning of those events for the offender. It's an inherently subjective, individualised process, which is therefore sensitive to difference. and diversity. The metaphor I tend to use here is that the journey of desistance has some similar elements for most people, but the terrain on which the journey takes place is dramatically different depending on how you're positioned socially and culturally. So if you happen to live in a context or in an ethnic group, or because of gender dynamics, you live in a context where you have easy access to work, educational opportunities, supportive families, where you're not surrounded by stigmatising consequences of your involvement in crime, your pathway to desistance might be much simpler than if there's no way back for you into, I'll say, ordinary, in inverted commas, family life, or ordinary employment, or other ways, other resources for identity shifts and transformation and for social inclusion. So it's very sensitive to difference and diversity. Hope seems to be a critical internal factor. Soliciting the process of change can be solicited or sustained by someone who maintains belief in the possibility of change. This is interesting from the point of view of social work values. We've tended to hang on to belief in the possibility of change as something that we cleave to as a principle in social work. But actually, there's empirical evidence in relation to resistance that hope is a key asset. And actually, that's true across psychosocial and psychotherapeutic literatures, that expectancy effects, people going into treatment or intervention with the hope and expectation that things will improve, do better. And hope is important in desistance. I think the negative side of that story is that being given up on, being told that you're a hopeless case, which is not an unusual pronouncement in a sentencing decision, for example, that's probably counterproductive in relation to desistance. Being condemned as a bad sort, an inveterate offender, an immutable bad character, all of that shuts down on the prospects and potential for change. Desistance is also an active process, and one in which agency is discovered. A key difference between the narratives of persistent offenders and desisters is agency in the narrative. Desisters retain a passive voice in the way that they describe their past, but they have an active voice when telling the story of where they are now and where they're going in the future. So they somehow acquire command over the direction of their lives, or they feel that they've acquired that command. So the interesting question is, where does that come from? How is it that in the same social context, with the same pressures, somebody can move from being swept along with the flow, or on the tossed on the waves, if you like, to kind of holding the tiller in the ship that is their life journey? This is very metaphorical. How do you get there? How do you acquire that capacity? Even those issues of capacity and control and identity shift are obviously critically important, but if you have no social opportunities, no networks of possibility, no ways to move into the social world and realise the new identity, if your social capital, in other words, is very restricted and you're driven back on the resources of an illicit network, then your desistance, your prospects for desistance are going to be profoundly and adversely affected by that. So in old social work language, private troubles, public issues, person and environment, the environment plays a big part here, and interventions have to be aware of trying to build supportive social networks, and also at the broader political level, lobbying for ex-offenders' rights, access to work, access to leisure, access to all of the benefits of citizenship when citizenship is restored, which is one important aspect of desistance for which the prospects look a bit depressing in the light of the fact that the Prime Minister is nauseated by the fact that prisoners might vote. And yet, what we want them to be is responsible citizens. So we can worry about the social context at that level later, if you like. Lastly, desistance processes seem to need to be, or at least to benefit from, being certified through redemption or restoration. There's no intended religious meaning here. It's simply the transformed person, or the person who's put effort into their own restoration as a citizen, if you like, needs to have the negative identity cast off. That shift needs to be recognised by authority figures, some have argued, by the legal process, by the question of the rehabilitation of offenders in terms of criminal records, but also at the social level. People have to create opportunities to recognise what's been done, to recognise the change effort, and to basically say to the person, as Churchill might have said, you've paid your dues in the hard coinage of punishment, you're back amongst us now as a full and equal member. That's a kind of legal position, but it's also a social status, and both aspects of reintegration are important. Generative activities where an ex-offender makes a positive contribution in the community are a key way for that kind of interaction to take place. And Shad Maruna, who's a key researcher in this area, has written a very interesting recent paper about rituals of redemption, about the, you know, what kind of rituals do we need to reintegrate and to welcome back the ex-offender. Last slide on the distance theory, and then I'll crack on with the data. This is three recent attempts to provide a description of what the process of desistance is like, and it's drawn from a book chapter that Beth Weaver and I published a year or so ago called Travelling Hopefully, in a book called What Else Works. So the biggest study here, and probably the most significant one internationally, is the Giordano study, which is from North America. And Peggy Giordano's conclusion is that desistance happens when somebody develops, for some reason, an openness to change, a cognitive openness to change, a willingness to consider change. In that state of openness, there is exposure to and some reaction to a hook for change. And the hook might be anything from a very adverse life event, like an illness or an accident or the death of a friend or some person in the social network. It might be the experience of imprisonment, or it might be something more positive, like a new relationship or the birth of a child or the acquisition of a work opportunity or some new form of participation in civil society through volunteering, whatever. There's a range of different potential hooks for change. But if the person is hooked when they're in this state of openness, then the next step for them is to develop the capacity to imagine an appealing conventional self. In other words, a way of being me which is authentic to who I am and have always been, but doesn't require the maintenance of the behaviour that's been involved in criminal activity. So how do I shift? How can I imagine myself being true to who I am, but without that behaviour? And that's not as simple as it sounds if your identity is all wrapped up with participation, for example, in organised crime networks. To give you, the examples of Boyle and Collins, Jimmy Boyle and Hugh Collins, their autobiographical accounts of this process are really very interestingly different. So Jimmy Boyle's account talks about personal transformation and a change of the sense of self. Hugh Collins is much more determined to say that he never changed. He made decisions, he chose to live differently, he moved into different social networks and activities, but the continuity in his narrative about who he is much stronger than in Jimmy Boyle's account, but I'll not go further with that for time. Last part of the process for Giordano is a transformation in attitudes to the behaviour itself. So you stop regarding the way that you've been behaving as justified or acceptable or whatever. But that's the last part of the process, not the first. And that's the irony in criminal justice social work. We're kind of straight in there on offence-focused, challenging behaviour before we've even got openness or hooks or the possibility of anything different. The Vaughan study, Barry Vaughan's an Irish academic who has drawn on other research studies, not on empirical work of his own, to describe the process a little bit differently, but you can see the commonality there. You've got discernment, reviewing choices, you've got deliberation about the different courses of action, which involves the comparison of selves, who I am, who I could be, who I currently am, who I aspire to be, and then dedication or commitment to the new identity. And the SPOOC study is the Sheffield Pathways Out of Crime study, an important recent study in England, which has it slightly differently. The triggering event comes first, then the decision to try to change, then the thinking differently about yourself, then the action to support the change effort, and then the maintenance process. I've put at the bottom here, what's the point of all that? Where are you trying to get to? One of the problems with talking about desistance is that it's all about the process and it doesn't really allude to the destination. The implied destination here is successful social integration and longer-term compliance with the law. And I don't mean compliance in the sense of a Foucauldian nightmare of internalised discipline without any thought, where you don't have to be controlled anymore because your mind's been controlled, you've been trained in rationalities and technologies of the self that the state wants you to acquire. I'm talking rather about a more genuine moral engagement with the questions about what it is to live a good life as a good citizen in your world, in your life, with your networks and your possibilities. And in a basic sense, we're talking about people trying to arrive at what constitute good lives for them as good citizens. I'm not imposing any notion of morality here or saying what that means. I'm just saying some sense of a good life as a good citizen is the end point. So, what did Inspiring Change as a set of arts interventions do that might relate to this body of evidence about desistance from crime, and what's the evidence that it had any kind of positive impact at all on these complicated, messy, fragile, difficult processes of change? Well, first of all, some caveats. The prisoners that we spoke to in the focus groups were themselves very realistic and said things, a few of them, like, look, if you're expecting that this arts intervention will dramatically transform me or that it will mean that I don't reoffend again, you're barking up the wrong tree. That's just not realistic. Just as I've said as a criminologist, they said from life experience. There's no longer-term follow-up in our study. There's no funding to follow the prisoners out of prison or to do a longer-term analysis of reconviction data or any other measure you would care to choose. There's very limited opportunities to test progress in prison and very significant methodological problems with how you would measure that in the context of prison regimes. And there's no easy way to measure behavioural change in the prison context, because you would think, for example, we did think to some extent that we might get something useful from looking at disorder in prison, conduct reports for breaches of the prison rules, but they're very vulnerable to the way that staff choose to react to incidents or to prisoner everything from what they may perceive to be cheek or bad manners right through to outright aggression and physical violence. So it's an exceptionally difficult thing to measure behavioural change in prison, other than perhaps through self-report studies, and we couldn't do that in the resources available to us. So what we have instead is qualitative data that captures what we think are important steps towards secondary desistance. Desistance scholars talk about the difference between primary desistance and secondary desistance. It's very like, if you've done a sociology degree or studied sociology, primary deviance and secondary deviance. So primary deviance is the act itself, doing the deviant act, whether that's taking drugs or engaging in some sort of behaviour that's classified as deviant. That's primary, it's behavioural, it's doing the thing that's described as deviant. Secondary deviance is when you internalise the label and regard yourself as one of those sorts of deviants. So when you say, I am a drug user, I'm an addict, I'm a junkie, that's secondary deviance. And with desistance, primary desistance is the absence of offending. But it's very difficult to measure an absence. There's nothing there to measure. Secondary desistance is the acquisition of the identity that I'm an ex-offender, or better still, I've put that behind me and I'm something else. I've moved into a different way, as I've said, of being me, a different positive identity. So, ironically perhaps, or depending on how you view social research, the qualitative data is much better at getting at secondary desistance. And actually, secondary desistance is much more important than primary desistance, because primary desistance can just be a lull. You can desist primarily because you're stuck in jail. You can desist because you break a leg and you can no longer climb up a drain pipe and break into a house. You can desist because you happen to know that the police have you under 24-hour surveillance at the moment. None of those are very meaningful from the point of view of rehabilitation or change. But if we've got clear data about a shift in identity, which might still be imperfectly correlated with behaviour, you might still be relapsing, You might still be slipping back and to some extent still involved with crime, but if you're going through that longer term process of shifting identity and attitudes and values and so on, then that's a much longer term project, one which arguably is more important. So we coded the data. We didn't ask anybody really directly about reoffending or desistance, because that wasn't the point of the projects. Instead, we coded the data that we got about participation in the projects for issues that we thought spoke to maturation or responsibility, social bonds of different kinds, and identity shifts. And this is what we got. So first of all, I mentioned that prisoners themselves had been realistic about whether these kinds of interventions could, in and of themselves, produce desistance in some straightforward way. And most of them said, even in this focus group, actually earlier in the focus group, they said, no, they can't. But then later in the same group, you get this interesting exchange about the meaningfulness of the projects. They help people find themselves. You learn a lot about yourself. Like, people don't think they're good at things and then they realise that they are. They're talented, or maybe they make bonds with people and it makes it easier for them, some of them. Do you know what I mean? So it's those things, the interviewer says, that maybe you could continue, could contribute later to whether you reoffended or not. And the subject agrees. Now, you could say this is not very good research practice because there's a slight leading question in there. So I take the point on that. But it's interesting that what's being picked up here is a shifting perception of what the choices and chances might be. And this is a recurring finding. People begin to think a bit differently about what choices are open to them, what chances are open to them on release from prison as they participated in the projects. Looking at maturation, the stronger themes here were to do with an acquisition of a sense of responsibility in relation to the arts project. And one of the interesting things here was that performances focused the mind wonderfully well. The looming threat almost of having to perform on a stage in front of an audience, usually alongside international quality artists. I mean, can you imagine yourself the prospect of having to stand on stage with people from the Scottish Chamber Orchestra and play your guitar? Or, you know, being part of a theatre production where you were acting next to somebody who regularly appears on stage for the sits or the Traverse Theatre, or you know, all of the examples, or having your work, your self-portrait, hanging in the National Portrait Gallery of Scotland, alongside, you know, all the old masters, if you'll pardon the sexist language. So, the threat almost, or the prospect would be a better word, of a performance or an exhibition really focused the mind and encouraged participants to take responsibility for themselves in the process of producing the artwork, and for each other, especially when we were talking about group productions, as I was saying earlier. So it changed your thought. Instead of thinking like a prisoner, it got you thinking like a normal person. Well, what does that mean? Well, instead of thinking about yourself, one of the things about prison, this is a classic finding of prison sociology, is that it drives you into yourself and into defensive behaviours because it's a threatening environment. But instead of that, you get little context, a little bit of light flooding into the prison, where in the context of this creative activity, you're not just thinking about yourself and looking after yourself, you're engaging with other people and thinking about the interests of the group. Another quote on the same sort of theme, this is from the SITS project in Berlin, where the prisoners themselves came up with a script which was based on the idea of an ex-prisoner standing on a train platform facing a dilemma about which direction they were going to take, literally and figuratively, in terms of their future life. So here, the thematic of the play also clearly speaks to the desistance process itself. So it's a decision we all have to face when we get liberated. And what's happening in this context is that they're thinking collectively about the challenge that they'll face. Nobody's asked them to think about desistance or reoffending or reintegration or release, but they've created that as part of a creative process. Every single one of us will have to make that decision of whether we go to the licensed grocers or whether we go to the bus straight home. And that's the about as blunt a statement of ambivalence and vacillation as you could hope to find. Every single one of us will have to make that choice. Okay. So moving on, and I realise I'm proceeding pretty quickly here through little nuggets of data, but you'll have to kind of trust me and maybe read the evaluation report to see that there's much more behind this in terms of evidence. On family ties, social bonds with family, very interesting again. The participation in the projects, sometimes as a result of the creative process itself, and sometimes as a result of the having something different to talk about in visits and having a performance that family would come to look forward to and to think about. The creative process got people thinking about family and the meaning of family. And so you get here the recognition that they're out there sticking by us, putting up with all this crap. And it's the good things they should be involved in as well. In our life, you know, our families are punished by imprisonment too. But when they see you doing something like this, it's letting them see that you're trying to better your ways, so to speak. You're not just in here being a thug. You get nice identity themes, nice stuff about social ties, connections, commitments, perceptions and so on coming through there. And this was, I just mentioned that the something I hadn't really thought about, but what do you talk about on an ordinary prison visit? Well, you talk about how life is outside. You might talk a little bit about how life is inside, but you don't have necessarily a focus for your conversation, which is different. And being able to talk in the visits about what they were going through in the creative process, it's a bit like coming home from a shift and talking about your work with your family, with your partner. That's something that again, we might take for granted when we have a difficult day or a bad day or a hard day at work. We've got something to talk about and someone to talk to. So it's not just the usual what you've been up to and what they've been up to. It's about talking about the play and all that, and you forget you were in jail. So you're in the prison visiting room, but for once you're allowed to forget that you're in jail and talk about something else. And that made it harder to go back to your cell that night. But even so, I think you'd have to read that as a positive thing. And then moving on to work, there were several examples I could use here, but just one from one participant, I think from Pullman, whose engagement with the music project there was deep enough to push him towards considering becoming a full-time musician, or trying to. And I think I'm right in saying that this person, we did manage to follow up a little bit post-release, and he is in college studying guitar playing, I think. And what he says here, I was quick to quit before, but now, with the support of the arts practitioners, with the process of being committed to the performance, he's stuck at something, he's learned something about his capacity to see something through, and he's following it up. Post-release, it's giving him a bit of inspiration. That was a gift of a quote for the Inspiring Change project, obviously. And then social networks. So the opportunity to engage with different social networks outside linked to the arts activity. So Citizens Theatre is very good at this in terms of its involvement in community arts. And this particular participant, again, I think from the Berlini project, is following up outside, staying in connection with a social network which is formed around interest in theatre, not interest in crime or more negative activities. Doors opened is the line at the end there. Now coming to identity, and this was one of the most fascinating aspects of the data for me. I guess we should have anticipated this given what I was saying from the Desistance literature about the significance of rituals. But I hadn't really thought about performance as ritual until the data started to come through. So there's lots of quotes from participants in the different projects, and it doesn't really seem to matter what kind of performance it is, whether it's a theatre production or a musical performance or even an exhibition in an art gallery. The fact that there's a performance, the fact that your work is going before figures of authority. So they've got the governor, deputy, social workers mentioned in some of the quotes. Other authority figures who are used to processing you as a prisoner are seeing you as an artist. Alongside, I'll use again the scare quotes for proper artist. So you're on stage alongside with access to all the sort of social and cultural capital that comes from these people who are working with you and who are regarding you as an equal participant in the creative process. And then you go up there and you do your thing, And the wardens there, the social workers are there, there are other people there, your family come in. I thought it was fantastic. So both the public audience, the formal authority figures, and the private audience, the family, again, that the significance of the family seeing you achieving something good, doing something good, which was clearly, for many participants, quite a novel and a very positive and a very powerful experience, as you might expect. So the performance of identity, and think now of the connection to imagining a different self, you can see why that would be incredibly reinforcing of a belief or a hope in the possibility that it might be possible to live differently. And then relationship, another really important and interesting variable here. The way, one of the reasons why I think the projects worked as effectively as they did was that first of all, the prisoners regarded the artists as artists. So they were coming in as artists, not as prison workers, not as social workers. They were coming in as artists, plain and simple. They were proper artists, again, in inverted commas. And the fact that these proper artists had willingly come into the prison context to work with prisoners was something that they regarded as amazing. And then if you added on to that the way that they were treated by the artists, which was just basic humanity. There was no... I think the arts organisations were quite careful about who they chose from within their companies or orchestras, whatever, to participate. But they were coming in not as skilled arts therapists, not as social workers or counsellors or trained in any particular way necessarily to engage with this specific population, but they just came in and treated people with humanity, and they formed relationships, and they did the art. That was what mattered. There was no judgment. They asked us questions. They wanted our input. The prisoners felt respected. I thought this was interesting as well on the theme of identity. I think this is from the National Portrait Gallery's work at Castle Huntley. I think it's from the pinhole camera work that Finn McRae did in this project with prisoners who were in the open estate. So they're in open conditions and with a lot more time at home. And as they went home, having taught them pinhole camera techniques, they would take pictures that represented aspects of family life and then come back. And there's interesting stuff here. I just like the idea of refitting your identity in the way that you might refit a shop or refit your style. So, to summarise, a quote from the report basically trying to pull the strands together around desistance, arts interventions, and the data that we have here. So, it may be that performances and exhibitions provide a kind of ritual where an esteemed audience recognised and celebrated achievement and change. It seems significant that these audiences comprised both professional and authority figures and family members. So both the public and the private audience of the prisoner's performance. Part of the function of certification rituals is that they confirm not just to the audience but to the participant the authenticity of the achievement, the potential of such experiences in terms of encouraging nascent or newborn belief in the possibility of progress or change is easy to see. So I think that's one of the most important and interesting findings for this from me. And I'll conclude with a couple of slides that kind of discuss some of the implications of this, first of all methodologically, and secondly more substantively for practice in this area. So the challenges for evaluators, we've been really struggling with this. Was this a process evaluation or an outcome evaluation? I don't know if that matters very much to you out there if you're not a researcher, but one of the interesting things about this project is that, for me, the outcome is to progress a process. That's hideously complicated. So when we typically evaluate criminal justice interventions, it's as if we imagine that there's a line that people will cross, and that if they cross it, we say tick, and if they fail to cross it, we say cross. So that's reconviction or not reconviction, or some other measure. It's not that isn't, in fact, what we're evaluating in criminal justice interventions. What we should be evaluating is progression in a long-term project of integration in society, successful social integration. There's no line to cross. We're all of us continually accomplishing or failing to be integrated, successful members of our communities. So how do you evaluate that? Well, not by creating an artificial line, painting it or drawing it in the sand and then counting who crosses and who doesn't cross. So a really interesting evaluation dilemma. I think if you accept the logic of that position, that you're evaluating progress along a journey or the progress of a process, then you have to think about what are sometimes disparaged as softer measures, but measures which are theory-based. So, for example, here the identity stuff as opposed to behaviour-based. And I think most criminal justice interventions probably get that wrong. Cost-effectiveness, well, that's, we were asked to do that, and that's further confounded. If there's no line to cross, how do you find a way to capture distance travelled in a way which is quantifiable enough to satisfy people that are concerned with financial questions? That's a challenge. And one really interesting thing which has been coming home to me recently from another project I'm involved in, which I'm not talking about today, but that project is about quality in probation practice, and the data that we're getting from that project, from practitioners, and to some extent from reviewing research on probationers' perspective, is that what gets counted isn't what matters, and what matters isn't what gets counted. And I get the feeling from this evaluation that we've begun to find a way to measure intermediate indicators that get at what matters. But whether other people see them as what counts is, well, for them to consider. And then more practically, for arts practitioners or arts organisations, and for those of us involved in the now hideously termed business of offender management, what are some of the practical issues? Well, I haven't necessarily spoken about all of these in representing the data. These are just thoughts that came to mind in sort of mulling over some of the responses to the evaluation and the event. We were at an event at the end of February where we spoke about the evaluation report and the whole Inspiring Change programme was reviewed. And one interesting set of problems is around audiences' expectations. So the funders might want something like tangible proof of effectiveness. The authorities might want something specific out of the project, but the families, the prisoners, might have slightly different expectations and wishes. And the public in England, in NOMS, they're now very scared of doing arts-based interventions because they fear that they may fail what they call the public acceptability test. In other words, would an ordinary member of the public regard giving a prisoner this opportunity as a legitimate or an illegitimate aspect of being punished? And if the answer is they would regard it as illegitimate, it doesn't run. So English prisoners are suffering. They can't do constructive things because they might fail the public acceptability test. So there's an audience expectation issue. There are big issues around interagency communication and cooperation. I'll not talk about that today, but that we found some difficulties with relationships between committed staff who are working in prisons, in learning centres specifically, doing offender literacy, doing arts projects themselves, and they're in there for the long haul, and then a very glamorous external outfit drops in to do a 6 or 8 week project, and that's a difficult dynamic in some contexts to manage unless there's very clear communication at an early stage. There are conflicting purposes, and that links to the question of expectations. There's a really thorny set of issues around editorial control, and that might be at the political level, the editorial control of the arts products, if you like, themselves, if they might be seen to cause a political problem. So let's say that a prisoner wants to produce a play in which certain pro-criminal attitudes are valorised or celebrated and not challenged or addressed in any way. What's the artist's proper response to that? To go with self-expression or to take responsibility for engaging in a challenging conversation about what should and shouldn't be represented. So there's the political, there's the ethical, who owns the arts process and its products. There's the authorial control of that. And there's artistic things. What about the tension between the performance looking really good which you might, frankly, soup up a little bit by giving the arts practitioners more input and the prisoners a bit less, versus sacrificing a little bit of the glossy production for more prisoner participation. So there are all sorts of really quite thorny practice issues for the arts practitioners. Some fantastically interesting ideas coming out of the project, and just from the discussion, even amongst the academic group, coming from our different perspectives about art. One of the things that artists have is expertise or mastery. Again, apologies for using the sexist term mastery, but they have commanded a certain skill through diligence, hard work, years of practice, training, commitment, and dedication, and that gives them a certain authority. You know, both as a role model, this idea of them coming in as proper artists, that the sense of mastery that's implied in that is one of the assets that they bring. There are other human skills, personal characteristics, and even moral qualities that they bring as human beings, which I think were profoundly important here. And some interesting questions about how important is it that they're great artists? And how important is it that they're great human beings? And, you know, how many are there that are both? And where do we get them from? So there's those questions. And then the practical challenge, if again, from the desistance literature, what I think we see here clearly in the data is evidence of first steps towards desistance. So there's something has been initiated through this kind of participation in arts projects, but it will quickly die if it isn't sustained and supported inside the prison and outside. So how do you follow this up inside a prison context, particularly for a long-term prisoner? And how do you follow it up outside? What is the role for criminal justice social work, for community justice organisations, and for community arts projects? What degree of engagement is there currently between community arts organisations and community justice authorities, criminal justice social work departments? Why is this all about prison? Why isn't it about people serving sentences in the community as well? So there is a whole interesting set of challenges about that. I'm pleased to report that the Creative Scotland has determined to take some of this work forward, and that I think the reference group who are going to be supporting the development will be looking at that question to some extent, or at least I hope they will be. And lastly, and finally, and this is probably where it gets back to social work, the other project on probation quality is very preoccupied with the question of engagement and the significance and importance of human engagement as a necessary prerequisite of any process of co-production of change. I've quoted Beth here. Beth Weaver has a very important, I think, article just published in the British Journal of Social Work, which is about co-producing community justice, in other words, drawing on the personalisation agenda, although with a bit of critique. She asks the question, to what extent are we prepared to listen to and engage seriously with user voice in the context of community justice and criminal justice social work? I think there's a link here to this question of engagement. How do you get relationships of the quality that can underwrite and sustain the kind of complex change process that I've been talking about? And I think key piece of learning for me as somebody with barely an artistic bone in my body is that arts projects are very good at engagement for reasons that I think I've already articulated. And there's something that we need to learn from that for social work methodologies and for social work practice too.
This recording is copyright of Iris 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licences, attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 2.5, UK Scotland licence. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.